Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Amwha Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Amwha Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I am your host, Adam Lowther. And today, as every single, I say this over and over, we always have great guests. That's part of what we do. That's part of the NucleCast magic. And so, of course, I'm glad for today we have another great guest, and that's Dr. Ben Zwabelson. He's U.S. Army retired. Ben, welcome to NucleCast, of course.
Adam, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and Ben, for me as a former SAMS professor, as a guy who's in Saudi Arabia right now creating the Saudi version of SAMS, it's great to talk to Ben because Ben is one of those guys who's really gotten good at design methodology. So for many of you Air Force folks or Department of Energy folks, you may not be all that familiar with design. Because, we as Air Force folks were raised on effects-based operations and an alternative way of thinking about it. But Space Command and others and the Marine Corps have picked up on design. And so Ben has gotten really, really well known for his work on design. And he's got a new book out called Bad War Stories. You can, if you're watching the podcast, you can see it. Oh, there it is. It's got a great jacket. The jacket, is fantastic. So look at that. Okay. So great jacket. And, he talks a lot about, the implications of design and strategy and how it applies to war fighting. And so we thought, let's have Ben on to talk about the book. I know, Ben, this is generally a nuclear focused podcast. But, planning is everything. We in the nuclear world, we do a lot of planning. And so I thought, well, planning and nuclear, it's important. So let's have Ben on to talk about bad war stories. With that, Ben, it's great to have you. Let me just ask you a sort of a broad question to start us off. So you've written a couple of books before. This one was sort of a labor of love for you. Tell us about the book, what is it about and what made you you just had to write this specific book?
Well, Adam, great question. And I think at the beginning it's a challenge, right? How do we fold this back into nuclear deterrence? And I think I could with this book in particular, in that my experiences and many of our listeners who have been part of the global war on terrorism period, whether it was Operation Iraqi Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom, or any of the other types of deployments and activities over really the last two decades plus. And still today, we have a very robust Islamic State and ideological terror movements around the world that continue, and those are an extension of those periods. But going back to the nuclear, this has to be framed originally. This book, Bad War Stories, really starts in the mid-20th century with the advent of the first atomic weapons, which were going to be developed by one side or the other, the Americans with the Manhattan Project, and then the Soviets in 1949, leveling the playing field and creating a new environment for our species. Previous to this, previous to the 1949, we could pursue kind of that Clausewitzian ideal of absolute war, right? We could invade and go full throttle with everything possible. And the only thing slowing us down would be like technology and resources and whatnot. But nations could go full throttle without recourse. Nukes changed this. And so that's why deterrence is here, is because this is an existential crisis. And since the 1940s, late 1940s into the 50s, societies have perpetually been in this new state that our species hadn't experienced before, which is all conflict that deters an acceleration into a nuclear conflict involves a greater calculus of accepting more defeat, more failure, right? And that's what brings us to my book, which is in my experiences through four different combat deployments from the invasion of Iraq all the way through the first or second phase of the Afghan withdrawal in the mid 2015 period. We were always fighting with one hand tied behind our back, strategically and operationally, and that extends into that nuclear deterrence equation that's always at play. And that ties into what is a bad war story and why is the book titled that way? So this has about four different meanings. The first is that these stories are not good. This is not about me being the door kicker on SEAL Team 6, schwacking Bin Laden and all that exciting stuff. You know, it's not Jack Reacher. It's none of that stuff because, frankly, most of what Hollywood creates and manufactures is exactly that. It's a copy without an original. It's simulacra. It's fake. There are people that have incredible, extraordinary experiences. I'm not discounting those. But most people that go into conflict today, not only is one hand tied behind their back in terms of institutionalisms and other hamstrings and policies and things that are directed by people that aren't even on the battlefield, but they're trying to understand it. And oh, by the way, they watch Hollywood movies too, and that's what they think is happening in the war, which isn't really. But the experiences of most people that go into these conflicts, there's enormous periods of monotony and boredom and frustration and misery and suffering and frustration with periodic moments of terror and confusion and shock and lurching yourself with your team into something and saying, are we doing it right? Go, go, go. And then afterwards, you're kind of reflecting going, did we do that right? Did it work? Are we okay? Is everything good? Sometimes great tactical successes over and over and over just make a good deployment. Everyone goes home with medals. People carry a lot of trauma home, but there's no strategic follow-through because guess what? For those that have done multiple tours, here you are. You're back in Iraq or you're back in Afghanistan. It's 2 years later. It's 1 year later. It's 3 years later. What has changed? We're still doing the same things. The ball hasn't really moved down the field. Maybe we got new kit. We got some new buildings. We got some new T-walls, whatever. So this is some of the stuff that goes into what a bad war story is. There's not glamour and there's not heroism. And this book is organized in kind of a Pulp Fiction way. It's out of order, so that's another bad reason. And then lastly, these stories challenge the institution in a productive way, but I need to call the emperor out for being naked. And we have to have some very serious discussions as a profession on the things we did in terms of long-enduring, decades-long patterns of you have to do it this way because that's the way it's taught at the planning school. That's the way it's in doctrine. That's the way we've always done it. We got to keep it this way so that you can move through the career rungs and get up the greasy pole. And everything just continues to go until it doesn't work. And actually wasn't working in many cases. So that's bad war stories. And then the last piece is that these are actually pretty good stories. They are entertaining. It's just a bad title.
Well, that's a great introduction. So as I sort of think about it, you know, I'm always looking for, you know, we as humans have a tendency to try to learn through analogy. And we, you know, we learn through, you know, historical cases. Some, you know, it's like, you know, that saying, you know, all analogies are wrong, but some are useful. And so, you know, we tend to do that, but for somebody who's, you know, largely, I mean, you're a design guy, you're a planner, among planners. And as you try to then take all that experience and education that taught you to be sort of a leader of the planning movement, and then you apply it to, you know, what we might call, I think the scientific term for it is what might be called total shit shows. And you take all that planning and you apply it, there's then lessons that are learned out of that. So kind of what are some of the lessons that you learned? And then, you know, for you, can you think of any ways where we, the nuclear community, can sort of learn from the experiences that, you know, you as a planner, having gone through trying to make this stuff work in real life, you know, what can we learn from it?
All right, that's a layered question there, Adam. Let me try to hit it from a couple angles. First, on the nuclear side, we're about to enter a period of extreme technological disruption. As a species, we're essentially at a cliff, but we're also putting a jetpack on. And this jetpack could propel our species not only just towards the stars. We're talking about an expansion into a multiplanetary species, which is just, it's as shocking as the first creatures waddling out of the water and working on land, breathing air. It's that big a shift. And I don't think enough people think about it that way, because we've been inundated with Star Trek and Star Wars and all these different science fiction stories that just make it just commonplace. But this is a big deal. The second thing, though, two more planks that will make nuclear far more terrifying in the decades to come. The first is artificial intelligence, specifically artificial general intelligence. I've written several articles on using Nick Bostrom's concept of the singleton entity. And this is a little bit like the Skynet argument, but it's not, because this, we need to think differently. So there's the AGI problem that's coming up in the 2030s, if not sooner. And then right next to it, working in synthesis, is quantum. And so Q-date and quantum supremacy, these are things that a lot of people don't spend much time thinking about. And when military professionals hear the word quantum, they kind of go, you know, they're ducking out. And we need to have serious conversations about all these things. The institution, the military institution, struggles to have serious conversations about, I think Little Hart said it really well. He said, and I think he said this in the 1920s, in the interwar period, he said, there's only one thing harder than getting a new idea into the military mind, and it's getting an old one out. And that's that tension point. Is that, yeah, we are pretty good at understanding nuclear deterrence today. We're not good at understanding how the nuclear fits with space expansion, fits with quantum, fits with artificial intelligence. And if you look back at the last two decades of counterinsurgencies and efforts, in retrospect, our tactics were exceptional, as they always are. Our operations were by the book. I was in so many operational planning sessions in Iraq and Afghanistan at training centers. And if anything, it was just doctrinally beautiful, chef's kiss. But it ends up in a dog's breakfast, if you will. I love the Anglo phrase there, right? Instead of shit show, a dog's breakfast of strategic disconnects and failures, where organizations were doing. One story in here is in Afghanistan. I was on my School of Advanced Military Studies, SAMS. I was on my SAMS utilization tour, and I was with my British coworker who came from my same seminar. So we graduated SAMS. He went back to the UK, and then sure enough, we show up and we're desk mates in NATO training mission Afghanistan. And my friend, I put different names for everybody in this book, but my friend Sam will know that was him, obviously. We're there at our work one day, and a senior leader comes in with a bunch of glossy photos. And these glossy photos have all these Afghan police at the training center at Pakhtika province. And they're busy learning literacy, because that's what everyone wants. We're doing literacy. Because why? Because it's good, and it's nation building. It's this, it's that. It's blah, 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 blah. What it really resulted in is my friend Sam looked at the photos, and he saw all the Afghan students were busy, and they had the instructor leaning over, and it was so orchestrated and beautiful. But their pens were upside down in every single photo, because at the fundamental level, they were illiterate, and the entire system was faking it, and they were producing it to make essentially propaganda for NATO. And we point this out, and my British friend said it very cheekily, and that senior leader's face turned bright red as he looked at all the photos, realized what had happened, and then stormed off to yell at public affairs. And I imagine that counseling probably was more of, don't ever let this happen again, but never the question that needed to be, which is, what are we doing here? How are we advancing a narrative literacy when A, it's not working, B, they're not doing it and they're faking it, and C, here's the planner question of disruption. Do we really need them to be literate? Because right now, the Afghan senior police officer in Kabul is a former IED maker for the Taliban, and he's illiterate. They're running Kabul. I don't agree with the Taliban. I don't support the Taliban. But what I'm just saying is, was literacy really that important for us to be spending all that time on?
Yeah, now that's one of the challenges to like building a good strategic assessment. Like, what assumptions do you make? What biases do you have? You know, are you thinking in the right frame? And that's really kind of we're having a strategic planning discussion, but whether it's planning for Afghanistan or Iraq, or whether it's nuclear planning and thinking about what will the Chinese or the Russians do, all of those things, you know, you take into account when you design your operation. And whether it's a deterrence operation, or whether it's, you know, go find a guy in a rural village in Afghanistan, it doesn't really matter. The point is you got to get these things right.
Yes. Yes.
Now, it's that time of the show where we got to take a quick break. So we'll do that. And then when we come back, I want you to give me, you know, give the listeners, like, what is your favorite story? And then what is the lesson to be learned from it? So you're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the Amlaw Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, and we're talking to Ben Zwabelson. He's got a great book, Bad War Stories. You can see it over his shoulder if you're watching the podcast. It's there. It is right there. It's a great cover. If nothing else, go to Amazon and look at Bad War Stories and look at the book jacket. And then you can just buy a copy if you want. So your favorite story, Ben, and what is the lessons to be learned from it?
All right, Adam, that's a tricky question for me, because my kids and family members and friends, they're not military, even though my family's traveled. They're part of the military family, but people are always asking, you know, what is war like? What is this like? And they're yearning for it, because, again, people can watch Hollywood. They can watch these manufactured things, and it's just not real. I remember when I was in the 82nd Airborne, a long time ago, we had Mel Gibson come because he was filming We Were Soldiers Once and Young, and he was getting some training. And the Special Forces guys were funny, because they kept messing with him and asking him, hey, here's the Beretta. I want to see you do that rolling on the ground Lethal Weapon shooting that you did. And they're joking. But they brought together all of the Black Hawk Down people for a separate event. And the director of that movie spoke with the veterans that were consultants that were involved. And he upfront apologized and said, hey, listen, what you're going to see in the movie, there were things that were changed. A couple things had to be done politically for a variety of reasons people can look up on Wikipedia later. But it's a story designed to put popcorn in mouths and butts in seats, right? That's number one. Sell tickets. Number two, story. And that's where these stories are not designed. This is not supposed to become a Netflix series. Although, if Netflix wants to call me, by all means. But this is not fair for a good movie. And it goes into my favorite story, or my favorite series of stories, are the most difficult to talk about. And those involve the death of children. I've suffered through the deaths of comrades, I've seen plenty of enemy killed in action, a lot of innocent workers and civilians that are killed, but it's when you are up close and personal with the death of a child, it's not a favorite story, but it is the most emotional baggage I carry for the rest of my life, because those are burned into your memory. And the military doesn't prepare you in any training to navigate those effectively. So other parts of this book deal with how I was navigating these challenges and interacting with people that couldn't. There's a series of discussions on suicide or suicide attempts, drug abuse, people that panic and urinate themselves while under fire. And a lot of these challenges are people that aren't given the right training, doctrine, education, experiences. They're not prepared to do these acts of war, and some are. There are some things like U.S. Army Ranger School. That's a phenomenal course that I believe firmly as a graduate that prepared me to endure some of the hardships. But at the same time, there's nothing in Ranger School that has you up front with a dead child laying there from an IED strike, or a father in Iraq at a patrol base because we took rocket fire. And sadly, the Al-Qaeda, they're firing it randomly, right? They're just trying to create an effect. And if they kill Americans, great. If they kill some poor kid who was going out into his field to do his morning chores, now he's dead. And his father has brought him to the medics in the aid station because they believe there's some sort of magic, the American technology, and we can fix the kid, right? We can bring him back from the dead. And the medics just say, no, there's nothing you do. And I walk up, and that man's, his expression will forever be etched in my mind. The sadness, the despair. And we didn't say anything. And I could speak Arabic at that point relatively conversationally. And I had nothing to say. I couldn't say anything because I'm thinking about my kids back home and how horrific all this is. And so those are some of the things that I work into a lot of these stories. And I always use certain techniques here. And readers that pay attention and enjoy this type of stuff, there's a lot of metaphoric devices, such as in one story, a child is murdered. Who is being sexually exploited as well, and he's covered with a sheet in a ditch because of the circumstances. Meanwhile, a warlord is wrapped in a beautiful carpet who's been killed. And so there's the discussion, the symbols of this is Afghan culture of how they were caring for the dead. This boy ends up in an unmarked grave west of Kandahar, nameless. He was an orphan. And then along the way, I work in things like I have a white coffee mug and there's cold coffee. And so these metaphoric devices are woven into the story to talk about the symbolism. And it's my personal way as a veteran and as an author of kind of working through that trauma. And so this was a very cathartic book for me to provide for everybody that's interested in these things. And then there's other examples, such as there's a young girl and boy who were in the green zone in Afghanistan, and they would always greet us when I was on a staff officer type assignment, and you'd walk through the green zone, and they'd always be begging for candy and selling you sodas and doing whatever. And I would always carry some Jolly Ranchers in my pocket, and I would give these kids that candy because I missed my kids. And one day, gave the girl some candies in the morning. We come back at night, and there was a suicide bomber that tried to attack our compound, failed, blew up outside, killed her. So I always wonder, did she eat the candies before that happened, or were they still in her pocket? And I don't know. But I put it in the story. It's in there. And again, all this stuff is 100% true. I have tweaked names and units and merged some people and modified things just to keep myself from getting lawsuits. But this was clear to the Army. There are no secrets in here. But they are bad war stories.
Yeah. Is there, if you think about sort of like what the nuclear community can take away from what you've learned from putting the book together, thinking through it, thinking through sort of the lessons, I wish we would have thought about this differently or done this or Why did we make this mistake? Sort of what is that?
The overarching takeaway for this book is institutional failure is reinforced by a lack of curiosity and innovation. So the nuclear community is in a very tight left and right limit of tolerance. Deterrence only works until it doesn't. And the second deterrence doesn't work, we run right into existential crisis. And that will be amplified in the 2030s with artificial general intelligence, with quantum, with the movement to nuclear power in the space domain. We have to do that. For example, the Firefly moon rover, they'll be the first company to put a rover on the moon. It's amazing. But that little lunar rover is only going to last 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks if you're lucky, because the conditions on the lunar surface are so extreme that you really need a nuclear power source. That's where space is going to go. And then that folds in a whole bunch of other deterrence challenges. Now, taking one step back and bringing it back to, okay, this is a book that centers on counterinsurgency affairs in Iraq and Afghanistan, spanning about approximately two decades, of which less than 0.5% of the American population ever stepped foot or had a role in these conflicts directly. So most of society doesn't understand it. But everyone lives and has lived in a nuclear world. From baby boomers and Gen X, where you had to do the drills where you climb under the desks at school and these types of things. And even then, I was in like sixth grade, and I was like, wait a minute, we just learned in science class that like the nuclear fallout, like, we're all going to die. Why are we going under the desk? We're just delaying things. But deterrence works because you can have small wars and accept strategic success in exchange at times for tactical defeat. So some of these wars, we are going to be willing to lose, right? And that's happened before. We've seen that in the Soviet-Afghan war. We've seen that in America and Vietnam. There's patterns where foreign policy and international relations works in a way that we don't want to hit the nuclear threshold, so we're going to do things down here to include putting lives at risk and sometimes just doing simmering insurgencies that have high risk for the combatants. But those people just kind of endure and do it, and then they come back here, and then we throw some money at the VA, and then we just forget about it, kick it under the carpet, and the institution moves on. And my argument would be, look, we shouldn't be doing this kind of madness if there's a smarter way, but it requires the institution to say, hold on a second. When we send forces in to do these low-level counterinsurgency or raids or certain types of activities, the tactics are great, but what about the operational effects and the long-term strategic outcomes, which most military professionals say, well, that's for the policymakers, and that's for the generals, and that's for the Pentagon. But those areas are filled with senior leaders that have to advise those senior policymakers and civilians on how we should do these things. So it really helps if you say, hey, if your strategy sucks and you haven't thought about things such as, does Afghanistan really need a centralized form of government? Does it need to be secularly structured? Can we not utilize Sharia law and localized warlords? No, you can't do any of that. You can't do any of that. But that's the default setting of Afghanistan, essentially. And that's where it is right now. The Taliban, they don't really project a lot of power. It's all decentralized, and they're all using a version of Sharia law with warlords, right? And tribes. It's all tribal. We didn't play to that. We never did. We did tactically, right? The Afghan local police and a lot of really good stuff that SOCOM was doing and infantry units were smart about it. But the strategy that was way up top, and I spent, you know, multiple years doing that as an operational planner, completely disconnected to the point where we're posing people with pens upside down because we're so desperate to create this false narrative.
Yeah. Okay, so we're at that time in the podcast where I want to bring out Bob the Genie. And so as I rub my magic lamp, Bob the Genie grants all guests 3 wishes related to the topics we've been discussing. So with that in mind, Ben, what is your first wish?
I would say my first wish off the top of my head would be the word innovation should not be, and design is tied into this, but the word innovation shouldn't be a dirty word, and it shouldn't be a doctrinal word. Because as soon as you say innovation, people run to follow the prescribed doctrinal processes, which aren't innovative. The last place we find innovation and creativity is in doctrine, because we have sucked out all the possible creativity to script it into a doctrinal form. And I'm not making fun or mocking doctrinal institutions and organizations. It's just we need to stop faking it. The innovation isn't there. Those are more of the guidelines of how to conserve and reinforce and gain efficiencies and reduce risk. If you're talking about doing innovation, you're increasing risk. You truly are. And that's what scares the institution. So my first wish would be innovation shouldn't be a dirty word, and it should become part of our warfighting ethos. Number one, we are innovative. And that means that it has to be taught at basic training. It has to be taught at the officer basic course. It has to be taught at the captain's career course. It has to be taught at the NCO entry level, PLDC or whatever they're calling it now. This is where those foundational components are, and they can easily be put in there. You don't need to be ivory tower, theory, philosophy. You know, you don't need all these books. What you need to do is tailor the training and the development of the entire warfighter community to be tolerant and, I would say, an entire paradigm shift towards innovation, which will potentially mitigate some of these challenges because the institution won't be so rigidly hierarchical. My second wish would be that we confront ourselves on our anti-intellectualism. I have forever been in this struggle where I joined the military to pay for college. I didn't want to be in the military, but I needed to pay for college. And I love my country. So I thought, hey, this will be great. And then along the way, I've always been a bit of an artist, right? A creative soul. And certain parts of the military love that, and certain parts of the military hate that. Because there's a certain type of anti-intellectual rigor of, you know, if you smash the door down and you get the door off the hinges, that's awesome. Well, what if you did an email hack and then you got somebody to open the door for you? Well, that's okay, but we don't make movies about that. We make movies about, you know, the guy with the, you know, wham, and they blow the door open and it's in slow-mo and there's doves flying and it's everything, right? So that ties to our culture. So the third wish is that American society that's not in the military, they've got to differentiate between the entertainment of Hollywood, the fake, the simulacra of war, and what war really is. And it involves a lot of pain, disruption, violence, the organization of violence, and long-term suffering for those participants, for those civilians, for the people that are living in the after effects of after all the units redeploy and everything's gone, we kind of brush our, and then the media doesn't want to talk about certain things, and we're not allowed to talk about that because you're part of this party or that party, and I you know, it's disgusting to me as a veteran to play the partisan games because none of that really matters. What really matters is, hey, if we as a society continue to do these things, regardless of who's elected or who's in office or who's making policy, the policymakers will just continue to make bad mistakes and hurt people. And in the long run, we need to be better at that. We shouldn't be treating. I see a veterans billboard on the way to work, and you know it's supposed to be positive, but they've got three people on that veterans billboard, and guess what? They're all missing legs. It's like 100% of the veterans are missing one leg. And I look at that and go, I'm not missing any limbs. And most of my peers aren't. There's a lot of problems that veterans have, serious problems. But the narrative that's put out there by society, that's reinforced by the entertainment industry and even the media, is this kind of false nonsense, which is unfortunate. So I'm sorry, I'll get off my soapbox.
No. It's a good one. You know, it's been great to, you know, to have this discussion. It's different from what we normally do, but, you know, it's good to sort of always broaden, you know, who we bring on NucleCast and, you know, hopefully for you, I'm sure some percentage of the NucleCast audience is going to be like, that was an intriguing discussion. Let me go to Amazon and pick up a copy of Bad War Stories by Ben Zwabelson. And so,
It's great if they do. And then if they like, you know, the kind of what we've talked about today, you know, this is a great opportunity. If they're interested in more of the theory and the philosophy and sociology, Helion also published Reconceptualizing War this past year as well. And that's really marked down right now on Amazon, so you can get it for a steal. But that's that heavier, that's that Sam's type stuff that you and I have spent a lot of time with. This is easily accessible for anybody to kind of pick up and read, and you can read it out of order. That's the design of the book, which again, it's a bad war story book.
All right. Well, Ben Zwabelson, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you next time. You know, Ben and I had written, we've written a couple of articles together on creativity and incorporating creativity into the professional military education system, you know, War College, Command and Staff, all of that. And so, you know, Ben's kind of a, you know, he's a SAMS guy. He's got a SAMS background. I've got a SAMS background. And so I thought, you know, a guy who thinks a lot about planning and about design would be a great person to have on the show. So it was a great discussion. It's not our norm, but, it'd give you something different to think about. So I enjoyed it. Hopefully you did as well.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krumpel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.